Chapter 38. "I think we had better get it done," said the bride, a bit anxious in manner, "since we are all here convenient to." Andrey gave way about the victuals, and the clerk called in a second witness who wouldn't be likely to gossip about it, and soon the knot was tied, and the bride looked smiling and calm forthwith, and Andrey limper than ever. "Now," said Passant Hugood, "you two must come to my house, and have a good lining put to your insides before you go a step further." They were very glad of the offer, and went out of the churchyard by one path, while the passant and clerk went out by the other, and so did not attract notice, it being still early. They entered the rectory, as if they'd just come back from their trip to Port Bredy, and then they knocked in the victuals and drink till they could hold no more. It was a long while before the story of what they had gone through was known, but it was talked of in time, and they themselves laugh over it now, though what Jane got for her pains was no great bargain after all. 'Tis true she saved her name. Apostrophe, was that the same Andrey who went to the squire's house as one of the Christmas fiddlers? Apostrophe, apostrophe, asked the seedsman. No, no, apostrophe, replied Mr. Prophet, the schoolmaster. It was his father did that. Eh, it was all owing to his being such a man for eating and drinking. Apostrophe, apostrophe, finding that he had the ear of the audience, the schoolmaster continued without delay. Old Andrey's experience as a musician. I was one of the choir boys at that time, and we and the players were to appear at the manor house as usual that Christmas week, to play and sing in the hall to the squire's people and visitors, among them being the Archdeacon, Lord, and Lady Baxby, and I don't know who, afterwards going, as we always did, to have a good supper in the servants' hall. Andrew knew this was the custom, and meeting us when we were starting to go, he said to us, Lord, how I should like to join in that meal of beef, and turkey, and plum pudding, and ale, that you happy ones be going to just now. One more or less will make no difference to the squire. I am too old to pass as a singing boy, and too bearded to pass as a singing girl. Can he lend me a fiddle, neighbors, that I may come with he as a bandsman? Well, we didn't like to be hard upon him, and lent him an old one, though Andrew knew no more of music than the Cern giant, and armed with the instrument he walked up to the squire's house with the others of us at the time appointed, and went in boldly, his fiddle under his arm. He made himself as natural as he could in opening the music books and moving the candles to the best points for throwing light upon the notes. And all went well till we had played and sung while Shepherd's Watch, and Tar, Arise, and Ark the Glad Sound. Then the squire's mother, a tall gruff old lady, who was much interested in church music, said quite unexpectedly to Andrew, My man, I see you don't play your instrument with the rest. How is that? Every one of the choir was ready to sink into the earth with concern at the fix Andrew was in. We could see that he had fallen into a cold sweat, and how he would get out of it, we did not know. I've had a misfortune, ma'am, he says, bowing as meek as a child. Coming along the road I fell down, and broke my bow. Oh, I am sorry to hear that, says she. And it be mended? Oh no, ma'am, says Andrew. 'Twas broke all to splinters. I'll see what I can do for you, says she. And then it seemed all over, and we played Aegis, ye drowsy mortals all, in D and two sharps. But no sooner had we got through it than she says to Andrew, I've sent up into the attic, where we have some old musical instruments, and found a bow for you. And she hands the bow to poor wretched Andrew, who didn't even know which end to take hold of. Now we shall have the full accompaniment, says she. Andrew's face looked as if it were made of rotten apple as he stood in the circle of players in front of his book, for if there was one person in the parish that everybody was afraid of, 'twas this hook-nosed old lady. However, by keeping a little behind the next man he managed to make pretense of beginning, sawing away with his bow without letting it touch the strings, so that it looked as if he were driving into the tune with heart and soul. 'Tis a question, if he wouldn't have got through all right if one of the squire's visitors, no other than the archdeacon, hadn't noticed that he held the fiddle upside down, the nut under his chin, and the tailpiece in his hand. And they began to crowd round him, thinking 'twas some new way of performing. This revealed everything. The squire's mother and Andrew turned out of the house as a vile impostor, and there was great interruption to the harmony of the proceedings, the squire declaring he should have noticed to leave his cottage that day fortnight. However, when we got to the servants' hall, there sat Andrew, who had been let in at the back door by the orders of the squire's wife, after being turned out at the front by the orders of the squire, and nothing more was heard about his leaving his cottage. But Andrew never performed in public as a musician after that night, and now he's dead and gone, poor man, as we all shall be. ... I had quite forgotten the old choir, with their fiddles and bass viols, ... said the homecomer, musingly. Are they still going on the same as of old? ... bless the man. ... said Christopher Twink, the master thatcher. Why, they've been done away with these 20 years. A young teetotaler plays the organ in church now, and plays it very well, though 'tis not quite such good music as in old times, because the organ is one of them that go with a winch, and the young teetotaler says he can't always throw the proper feeling into the tune without well-nigh working his arms off. ... Why did they make the change then? ... Well, partly because of fashion, partly because the old musicians got into a sort of scrape. A terrible scrape 'twas too, wasn't it, John? I shall never forget it, never. They lost their character as officers of the church as complete as if they'd never had any character at all. ... That was very bad for them. ... Yes. ... The master thatcher attentively regarded past times, as if they lay about a mile off, and went on. ... Absent-mindedness in the parish choir. It happened on Sunday after Christmas, the last Sunday ever they played in Longpuddle Church Gallery, as it turned out, though they didn't know it then. As you may know, sir, the players formed a very good band, almost as good as the Mellstock Parish players, that were led by the Deweys, and that's saying a great deal. There was Nicholas Padinkum, the leader, with the first fiddle. There was Timothy Thomas, the bass viol man. John Biles, the tenor fiddler. Dan Hornhead, with the serpent. Robert Dowdle, with the clarionet. And Mr. Nix, with the oboe, all sound and powerful musicians, and strong-winded men they that load. For that reason they were very much in demand Christmas week for little reels and dancing parties, for they could turn a jig, or a hornpipe out of hand as well as ever they could turn out a psalm, and perhaps better, not to speak your reverend. In short, one half hour they could be playing a Christmas carol in the squire's hall to the ladies and gentlemen, and drinking tea and coffee with them as modest as saints, and the next, at the Tinker's Arms, blazing away like wild horses with the ashing white sergeant to 9 couple of dancers and more, and swallowing rum and cider hot as flame. Well, this Christmas they'd been out to one rattling randy after another every night, and had got next to no sleep at all. Then came the Sunday after Christmas, their fatal day. 'Twas so mortal cold that year that they could hardly sit in the gallery, for though the congregation down in the body of the church had a stove to keep off the frost, the players in the gallery had nothing at all. So Nicholas said at morning service, when 'twas freezing an inch an hour, "Please the Lord, I won't stand this numbing weather no longer. This afternoon we'll have something in our insides to make us warm, if it cost a king's ransom." So he brought a gallon of hot brandy and beer, ready mixed, to church with him in the afternoon, and by keeping the jar well wrapped up in Timothy Thomas's bass viol bag it kept drinkably warm till they wanted it, which was just a thimbleful in the absolution, and another after the creed, and the remainder at the beginning of the sermon. When they'd had the last pull, they felt quite comfortable and warm, and as the sermon went on, most unfortunately for them, it was a long one, that afternoon they fell asleep, every man jack of them, and there they slept on as sound as rocks. 'Twas a very dark afternoon, and by the end of the sermon all you could see of the inside of the church were the pastor's two candles alongside of him in the pulpit, and his speaking face behind him. The sermon being ended at last, the pastor guided out the evening hymn. But no choir set about sounding up the tune, and the people began to turn their heads to learn the reason why, and then Levi Limpet, a boy who sat in the gallery, nudged Timothy and Nicholas, and said, "Begin. Begin." "Hey? What?" says Nicholas, starting up, and the church being so dark, and his head so muddled he thought he was at the party they had played at all the night before, and away he went, bow and fiddle, at the devil among the tailors, the favorite jig of our neighborhood at that time. The rest of the band, being in the same state of mind and nothing doubting, followed their leader with all their strength, according to custom. They poured out that their tune till the lower bass notes of "The Devil Among the Tailors" made the cobwebs in the roof shiver like ghosts. Then Nicholas, seeing nobody moved, shouted out as he scraped in his usual commanding way at dances, when the folk didn't know the figures, "Top couples cross hands. And when I make the fiddle squeak at the end, every man kiss his partner under the mistletoe." The boy Levi was so frightened that he bolted down the gallery stairs and out homeward like lightning. The pastor's hair fairly stood on end when he heard the evil tune raging through the church, and thinking the choir had gone crazy, he held up his hand and said, "Stop, stop, 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 stop. What's this?" But they didn't hear end for the noise of their own playing, and the more he called, the louder they played. Then the folks came out of their pews, wondering down to the ground, and saying, "What do they mean by such wickedness? We shall be consumed like Sodom and Gomorrah." Then the squire came out of his pew lined wide green baize, where lots of lords and ladies visiting at the house were worshipping along with him, and went and stood in front of the gallery, and shook his fist in the musicians' faces, saying, "What? In this reverend edifice? What?" And at last they heard end through their playing, and stopped. "Never such an insulting, disgraceful thing, never," says the squire, who couldn't rule his passion. "Never," says the pastor, who had come down and stood beside him. "Not if the angels of heaven," says the squire. He was a wickedish man, the squire was, though now for once he happened to be on the Lord's side. "Ought, if the angels of heaven come down," he says, "shall one of you villainous players ever sound a note in this church again? For the insult to me, and my family, and my visitors, and God Almighty, that you've perpetrated this afternoon." Then the unfortunate church band came to their senses, and remembered where they were, and 'twas a sight to see Nicholas Pudding come, and Timothy Thomas and John Biles creep down the gallery stairs with their fiddles under their arms, and poor Dan Hornhead with his serpent, and Robert Dowdle with his clarionet, all looking as little as ninepins, and out they went. The pastor might have forged them when he learned the true thought, but the squire would not. That very week he sent for a barrel organ that would play 22 new psalm tunes, so exact and particular that, however sinful inclined he was, you could play nothing but psalm tunes whatsoever. He had a really respectable man to turn the winch, as I said, and the old players played no more. And, of course, my old acquaintance, the annuitant, Mrs. Winter, who always seemed to have something on her mind, is dead and gone? Said the homecomer, after a long silence. Nobody in the van seemed to recollect the name. "Oh yes, she must be dead long since. She was 70 when I as a child knew her," he added. "I can recollect Mrs. Winter very well, if nobody else can," said the aged groceress. "Yes, she's been dead these 25 years at least. You knew what it was upon her mind," Sir, that gave her that hollow-eyed look, I suppose? It had something to do with a son of hers, I think I once was told. But I was too young to know particulars. The grocer's sighed as she conjured up a vision of days long past. Yes, she murmured, it had all to do with a son. Finding that the van was still in a listening mood, she spoke on. The Winters and the Palmleys. To go back to the beginning, if one must, there were two women in the parish, when I was a child, who were to a certain extent rivals in good looks. Never mind particulars, but in consequence of this, they were at daggers drawn, and they did not love each other any better, when one of them tempted the other's lover away from her and married him. He was a young man of the name of Winter, and in due time they had a son. The other woman did not marry for many years. But when she was about 30, a quiet man named Palmley asked her to be his wife, and she accepted him. You don't mind when the Palmleys were long puddle folk, but I do well. S. He had a son also, who was, of course, 9 or 10 years younger than the son of the first. The child proved to be of rather weak intellect, though his mother loved him as the apple of her eye. This woman's husband died when the child was 8 years old, and left his widow and boy in poverty. Her former rival, also a widow now, but fairly well provided for, offered for pity's sake to take the child as errand boy, small as he was, her own son, Jack, being hard upon 17. Her poor neighbor could do no better than let the child go there. And to the richer woman's house, little Palmley. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.